And it could be, depending on our karma, a long time before we had another such incredible opportunity to practice as this. Then let's really arouse our efforts and our energy and our delight in generating renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view. All the other EMLs, I always told the story of the Buddha at the beginning, and I think it might be good to do that now too, because when we hear the story of the Buddha's life, it gives us some idea of where we can go and how we should, the kind of same attitudes with which we train our mind. So the Buddha was a prince in Kapilavastu, which was a small kingdom in northern India or southern Nepal. And there are miraculous things around his birth and all that kind of stuff, as there usually are around religious leaders' birth. But the part about his life that really interests me the most is that he grew up in this very posh environment. He had anything he wanted. Because a soothsayer had a fortune teller had said at the beginning to his father, your son will either grow up to be a great religious leader or a great political leader. So of course dad wanted his son to follow in his footsteps. So he didn't want him to, you know, be religious at all. And he didn't want, and he very much sheltered Siddhartha. You know, he couldn't leave the palace, he could only be with these people and not with those people, and so on and so forth. So he grew up a very sheltered life. He did exactly what you're supposed to do when you're supposed to do it. He got married, had a child, and then he got a little bit curious about what was outside the walls. And dad wouldn't let him out. So he had to sneak out, like most teenagers. And people in their early 20s. So he snuck out of the palace and went into town. And the first time he saw somebody who was sick, which he had never seen before. Can you imagine, you know, being 20-something and never seeing anybody who's sick? So this may just be a legend, but, you know, still. So he asked his charioteer what that was, and his charioteer explained to him, you know, what a sick person was. And Buddha said, Siddhartha said, can that happen to me? And it was explained, yes, it happens to everybody. So he went home and he thought about that a lot, you know. And then he went out again and he saw an old person, which he had never seen before, somebody really old and decrepit and bent over and, you know, arthritic and no teeth and everything. And had to ask his charioteer what that was about and learned about old age and also that it would happen to him. Kind of a shock. Isn't it kind of a shock? Could you imagine looking in the mirror tomorrow and seeing an 80-year-old face looking back at you? Yeah, really rather shocking, don't you think? And then the third time he went out, he saw a corpse, which if you go to India for any amount of time, you'll see in the railway stations or on the roads or on the tops of buses or wherever. And at that time, you know, he had to ask the charioteer what that was and learned about death, and that was big. Thing. You know, oh, this whole thing ends, you know. and you're not there anymore. You're separated from everybody you care about and everything you have and your whole identity and everything you've spent your whole life cultivating and putting into place goes. And then the fourth time he went out, he's a wandering mendicant, a shamana, which he had never seen before. And the charioteer explained that this is somebody who's looking for the answer to how to get out of this cycle of birth, sickness, aging, and death. So he went home and he was even more thoughtful after that. And one night, you know, after all the pleasures of the harem and the whole the palace life and everything, all of the dancing girls who were so gorgeous had fallen asleep on the floor. And when people sleep, they're not necessarily beautiful. They snore and spit dribbles out of their mouth and they toss and turn and they fart and, they like that. So, all these dancing girls, it looks so great. And he really knew at that point, everything in samsara doesn't amount to much. What's beautiful and attractive and lovely in the end looks like this. And, I too am subject to sickness, aging, and death. And so he thought, I must leave this environment and become a shamana and search for the way out of this cycle of rebirth. So he left the palace in the middle of the night. His wife was sleeping, and so he just kind of heads by and left and got a certain distance away and took off all of his, fancy clothes and his earrings and jewelry. That's why the Buddha has very long earlobes, because his jewels were so heavy when he was a prince that it stretched out his earlobes. So he took off all his jewels, his finery, and then he cut his hair, because he had this long hair, as men often did then, and put on these rag robes and became a shamana. And so he went out searching for a teacher. He had two teachers, both of which had mastered different levels of meditation in the form of formless realms. And Siddhartha quickly attained those same levels of meditation, to the extent that the leaders of the group, first one group and then when he left that group, the other one, offered to share the leadership with him, because he had gone into these blissful states of meditation single-pointedly and had become equal to the teachers. But both times he left the teachers because he thought, I've attained this great concentration, but I'm still not free from cyclic existence. So I haven't attained my goal. So then he went to what is now the state of Bihar on one side of the river, and he meditated for 6 years with five friends of his. And at that time in India, it was very popular to be an ascetic and to do all sorts of ascetic practices. The idea being, and you find this, nowadays too, that if you're very attached to your body, then the way to break the attachment is to cause suffering to your body, because then you'll lose the attachment. That was the idea too, I think, behind in the Catholic Church until Vatican II, wearing hair shirts and self-flagellation and everything like that to kind of overcome the sinfulness of the body, the attachment to the body. Yeah, Buddhists don't see the body as sinful like that, but some people do. So he practiced very extreme ascetic practices for 6 years, eating only one grain of rice a day. And got so thin that they say when he touched his belly button, he could feel his spine. Okay, so very gaunt, very thin, kept on meditating, still no liberation. And at a certain point, he realized that these extreme ascetic practices were of no use. They didn't help to dispel the attachment to the body. And he knew that if he ate something and took care of his body, his mind would, you know, be able, because the mind is dependent upon the body, the mind would be able to focus better in his meditation. So he left his five friends, and one of the village girls gave him some rice porridge to eat. And then he crossed the Nirjana River and went and sat under the Bodhi tree. And his five friends thought that he had totally flaked out, you know. We were talking about what we're attached to in terms of our reputation. And people were talking about, you know, being irresponsible, not following through, being a flake. This is exactly what his friends said he did. You know, you flaked out, you're a weakling, you don't have what it takes, you're soft, you're never going to be a success, look at you. You know, they just thought he was messed up. But he crossed the river and sat under the Bodhi tree and started meditating in the evening and vowed not to get up until he had attained full enlightenment. And so, let's see, in the first wake of the night, well, first he had all these hindrances. And, you know, first all the dancing girls came, you know, the beautiful women who were very sexy and, you know, I don't know, incarnations of, who was that, Madonna or, I don't know, Spice Girls or, I don't know who's who, but, you know, all these kind of people, you know, kind of, but millions of them, and they were all Mara's daughters, you know, trying to entice him. And he turned them all into hags, and so they kind of crept away, very ashamed that they had been seen for what they were. Then Mara sent all the warriors and battlers to, you know, ferocious-looking monsters and soldiers and all the Osama bin Laden incarnations and Saddam Hussein incarnations and George Bush incarnations. You know, kind of all attacking him at once. And he turned all of their weapons into flower blossoms. So they also slunk away. Okay? Never get that word. Slunk. Okay. So, they were gone. And so then he kept on meditating. And in the first wake of the night, he had all these recollections of his previous lives. Okay? Very clear recollections of, like, countless previous lives. What effect do you think that would have on your mind if you saw all the things you had been born as before, and all the things you had done? Yeah, one lifetime sometimes is bad enough. But imagine seeing every negative action you had done in a previous life. Every pleasure you had had and how it had gone and failed. And how you had been up in the God realms, down in the hell realms, done everything. Do you think that might give you a little bit of renunciation of samsara? Yeah? You know, nowadays all these new age people, they want to see their previous lives. You know, if you really saw them, you really did, what would it do to your mind? It would be horrifying, you know, seeing the things that we've done in previous lives to harm other people and how deluded we were. And anyway, so that's what he saw so clearly that I think instigated very strong renunciation. Then in the middle of the night, he had the wisdom that arose that saw how all sentient beings were born because of their karma and died with their karma and were born again due to their karma and died again due to the exhaustion of their karma. What do you think that, if you saw that, just even one sentient being, born and dying and born and dying, totally controlled by afflictions and karma, what would that make come in your mind?
Compassion.
Yeah. So I think at that point, you know, very strong bodhicitta arose in his mind. And then he kept meditating. And then at dawn, he had the wisdom arise that knew the cessation of dukkha, suffering, and its origins. Okay, so he had that wisdom realizing emptiness that was able to eliminate all of the afflictive obscurations, all of the cognitive obscurations. And he became a fully enlightened Buddha. So there you have the three principal aspects of the path. So after he attained Buddhahood, he did some walking meditation, and he thought, you know, nobody is going to understand me. Okay? You were talking about people misunderstanding our motivations or what we're doing. Buddha's gone, nobody's going to get this. If I try and explain to them, they have too much dirt in their eyes. They won't be able to see. So all the powerful gods, Brahma and Indra and Sakaka and all these powerful gods, they came and they made requests to the Buddha. So all these powerful gods who everybody else, all the human beings honored, humbled themselves in the presence of the Buddha and requested him, please, to give teachings for the sake of those who had little dust in their wisdom life. So then the Buddha thought, okay, who should I teach? And he thought, well, what about my five friends? They were really sincere in their practice, but they didn't really know the correct path, so I should go and teach them. So he saw, you know, with his clairvoyance that they were in Sarnath, and he walked towards Sarnath. When he got to Deer Park, where his friends were meditating, they saw him, and they said, oh, there's that Gotama, that lazy bum, you know, don't set up a seat, don't offer him water, just, you know, he's a flake. But as the Buddha came closer, you know, just by his presence, who he was, without having to make any special effort to impress people, you know, his presence, they found themselves preparing a seat, offering him water to drink, and so on. And so then he gave the first teaching on the Four Noble Truths, which set up a structure for everything he had taught after that. And so one of had little dust in his eyes, and after that first teaching, he realized the level of stream enterer, which is the path of seeing, of the hearer path, and then soon became an arhat. And so after that, you know, the Buddha started teaching. He wandered, and because in India at that time, there were so many wandering ascetics. You know, it was totally socially acceptable, except for your own family. You know, your parents didn't want their kids to become a wandering ascetic, but they had respect for everybody else's kids who were wandering ascetics. Okay? It's kind of like in Singapore, how nobody wants their kids to ordain, but they love going to the temple, and they're so happy there's monks and nuns in the temple. So other people's kids. Yeah, a very similar thing. So he went all these different places and taught, and he always taught according to the disposition and the level of mental faculties of the various people. So he taught, he gave different teachings and said different things to different people, you know, according to what was going to benefit them at that particular time. And so the Sangha community quickly grew. Yeah, all these people started wanting to ordain. And once it hit the crucial number of 60, which actually isn't very many, then he enjoined them to go in different directions and to give teachings and to spread the Dharma. So the Dharma started to spread throughout India. And he continued being this wanderer, which was totally socially acceptable. So he would arise in the morning and do some meditation, and then go on alms round, collect the food. They would come back to a grove or a forest and share their food and eat, and then sit down at the foot of a tree for their meditation session. And they would meditate in the afternoon, and then usually around, you know, late afternoon, early evening, then very often the Buddha would give a teaching. And then after that, he would practice walking meditation and sitting meditation, and only slept in the 4 hours in the middle of the night, the second watch in the night, like from 10 to 2. And then arose early and did more walking and sitting, and then went on alms round and so on. Okay, so the Sangha community grew, and he did that for 45 years. Yeah. And he talked to all sorts of people when he taught. You know, many of them were princes and royalty. Many of them were beggars and outcasts. He was extraordinarily open in terms of who he taught. And he also had many conversations with non-Buddhists. He did a lot of interfaith dialogue. Yeah. And it was very interesting because many of the sutras are written about the discussions that he had with the non-Buddhists. And it's quite interesting. I should find a stop passage in here where they describe him going to see a group of non-Buddhists. And many times he went to see the Jains, Nirgantha, the head of the Jains. He was alive at that time as the Buddhist contemporary. And they were being described as being raucous and, you know, and everything like that. But when they saw the Buddha approaching to talk to them, they all got quiet and well-behaved, because the Buddha's disciples were quiet and well-behaved. You know, so they felt a little bit of positive kind of shame about their behavior. I should really see if I can find that kind of passage. It might take me if there's something. Let's try one at random here and see. He talked to Brahmins. That sutra is where he's talking to Brahmins. No, somebody else. Okay, anyway. There's different passages where it describes how the non-Buddhist disciples act, and they're like all over the place. And so for the Buddha, you know, really this mindful behavior, acting with clear comprehension of what one does, was so important. You know, Lama Yeshe used to say to us, you know, you can give a good visualization to other people, or you can give a bad visualization. Yeah? So by your actions you can, you know, inspire them, or you can discourage them. So a lot of these things, you know, that we were talking about yesterday, some of them were naturally negative actions that you abandon in order to avoid creating negative karma. And then some of them were not naturally negative actions, but things that were inappropriate for a monastic to do. Because it looked bad in front of the lay people, it made people lose faith, or because it brought you closer to breaking one of the root vows. So like I was explaining before, that many of the precepts were made because lay people complained about how the Sangha acted. And so many of the precepts involve etiquette and, you know, different trainings of things. Not about natural and negative actions, but just about behavior in general. So we can see that how the Sangha appears to the lay people is something that's important. Not because the Buddha was looking for his disciples to have a good reputation, but because he cared about the lay people and their spiritual practice, and that they would lose faith in the Dharma if, you know, his followers were just all over the place, you know, and bouncing off the walls and so on. Okay, so we're going to go into now the another section. This is from the first sutra in the long discourses, the sutra called What the Teaching Is Not. And so yesterday we talked about one of the sections on morality in that sutra. It was called the short section of morality. We're going to go into the middle section on morality now. And so many of the things spoken of here aren't necessarily negative, but they're things that are upsetting to people in society. And you may wonder why I'm going to read all these things to you, because some of them don't pertain to what we're doing now. But that's just the point, so that you can see kind of the situation of society and how the Buddha spoke of different things then. And even though the specifics may not relate to us, the points that the Buddha's trying to make very much relate to us. Okay. And so somebody asked me the other day about, you know, deciding what to adapt and how to do that. And one of the criteria that I use is, what was the point of the precept? In what circumstance did the Buddha create that? What kind of afflicted state of mind was he trying to get at and subdue? And then how does that apply to how we're living now? Okay. So, for example, there's one precept about in the morning you shouldn't take your chamber pot and throw it over a wall, okay? Because you might hit somebody with all your stuff, you know? So it's out of consideration for other people. Well, you know, I don't think any of us are going to do that. But what does it have to do with what we're doing now? It has to do with polluting the land and polluting the environment that we share with other people. So how we would practice it now is not draining the oil of your car, just any old place, you know, so it polluted a stream or something, and making sure that we recycle. Yeah. You have probably seen me turning off fans, turning off lights. I follow everybody around, because they often forget. You know, somehow being careful about the resources that we share in common, because, you know, the more we use, the more we pollute. And so people, that's why I carry on whenever somebody wants to run into town because they didn't think ahead, you know, because we're offering pollution to the environment that we all share. And in my mind, that corresponds very much with that precept about not throwing your chamber pot over the wall. Okay? So to take care of these kinds of things. And so I think that, you know, there's many things that aren't in the Vinaya that if the Buddha were alive today, he would make precepts about. I'm sure there would be quite a number of precepts about internet use. Okay, how long you could be on the internet, what things you could look at. You know, I'm sure there would be a thing that other people have to be in the room when you use the computer. Yeah, and that you could only look at things that, you know, look for things that a senior in the community asks you to look up in the computer, or you could only use it for research. You couldn't just, you know, go looking even for Buddhist pictures. I think I'll surf the internet to look at Buddhist pictures just because we're bored, you know, or whatever. So I think there'd be quite a number of precepts about internet use. Okay, and a number of precepts about driving. You know, you don't talk on a cell phone when you drive. You don't throw your litter out the window. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh, he went through and he kind of revised the Vinaya, or at least the Padimoksha, which are the specific precepts that we take, and added a number of precepts like this. It's quite interesting. I think we have a copy of it in our library. Now, so really kind of updating. So I think that's quite good, you know. I didn't read the whole thing, but I remember that, you know, you cannot be in the internet unless somebody else is in the room with you. Yeah? And I really see the value in that, because in Dharamsala, I had one friend who was a very good monk. He was hanging out, you know, in a chat room on the internet and met somebody and is married and has a kid now, you know? So that kind of thing can really be quite dangerous if you just start meeting people in the chat room and spending hours on the internet talking to who knows who about what knows what, okay? So I'm sure there would be precepts about that, about, you know, all sorts of things. You know? So we should, I'm sure we'll be thinking about that a lot at the Abbey. You know? Okay, so let's look some more at this middle section. Okay, so the Buddha speaking, he says, some ascetics and Brahmins feeding on the food of the faithful. So this is a phrase he uses very often, feeding on the food of the faithful. In other words, you accept food out of people, from people who have faith in you because you're doing the spiritual practice. But then, instead of doing your practice, it says here, they're feeding on the food of the faithful. They're addicted to the destruction of such seeds as are propagated from roots, from stems, from joints, from cuttings, from seeds, you know, and the ascetic Gotama refrains from such destruction. So again, I'm not sure why all of this. It could be because seeds, you know, it was an agrarian society and you needed your seeds to plant the next year. And, you know, or because there might have been bugs in them, or because the monastics didn't cook, whatever. Okay, whereas some ascetics and Brahmins feeding on the food of the faithful remain addicted to the enjoyment of stored up goods such as food, drink, clothing, carriages, beds, perfumes, meat. The ascetic Gotama refrains from such enjoyment. So here's talking about hoarding, stored up goods, okay? Actually, one of our monastic precepts is to not keep food overnight. Yeah, and you're only supposed to eat the food that is offered to you on that day. Yeah, so there's a few different reasons for this. One of them is, in ancient India, food went bad overnight because it was very hot. But also, I think, and more importantly, is the hoarding mentality of I've got to just stockpile stuff because I might not have enough. So that hoarding, fearful mentality of, you know, let's keep more than I need. And so the monastics weren't allowed to do that, either with their robes or with food. Nowadays, you know, but they were also wandering, and it was socially acceptable to wander. So when you went into town, people would generally give you some food unless there was a famine. And maybe not always, and maybe not the food you like, but you would usually get something to eat. Whereas now, going wandering, you know, in town, it's Seth Abbey, the folks do it, and the Abhayagiri folks have done it, that you have to go into town and talk to the city and get permission, and actually they had to get a permit to have a parade. That's what it was called, because there were a few different people walking one behind the other, and you know, you can't block doorways and things like that. So it is possible, maybe one day we'll do it in Newport. But what happened when Buddhism went to China was that was not socially accepted in China to go on Pindapat. It was seen as if you were begging. So it's actually, people say that the Buddha begged. It wasn't begging, it was alms ground. There's a very big difference between alms round and begging. Begging is you're asking people. Okay, alms round is you're just walking and it's completely their free choice in order to give to you. And it was beggars who begged, and it was the wandering ascetics, the religious people who went on alms round. So sometimes people say, oh, the Buddha has a begging bowl. It's not a begging bowl, it's an alms bowl. Okay, so you know, to counteract that mentality of hoarding. But when Buddhism went to China, like I said, it wasn't socially acceptable to do that. And so the monasteries, you know, began to keep stores of food and stores of different goods. But you don't keep it in your own personal room. You keep it in a common area that is roped off, so to speak. In other words, we've done that in the Abbey. There's certain areas where we're allowed to store food overnight, and that food belongs to the community, and so nobody is breaking a vow by the community storing the food. But still, as a community, I think that we should keep some food that's extra, especially in the winter, because you don't know when the power's going to go out and the snow's going to get snow blown in. But I don't think we should have so much food that we risk it going bad. And so what we often do, if we get a few different big bags of rice, is we'll take them to the food bank. You know, or food that people bring us that we don't eat, we'll take to the food bank or to one of the homeless shelters or things like that. So it's a delicate balance, because on one hand, people are giving us the food out of faith and they want us to eat it. Yeah, so we honor that. On the other hand, if there's risk that it's going to go bad, or if there's so much that it really is unbecoming to have so much, then we should give it away. And I find it's interesting that we're in this position, because when I set the Abbey up, because we're not buying food, people were telling me, you're not going to have anything to eat. You know? As we grow, yeah, it'll be another thing, because we'll have many more mouths to feed, so we'll see how that goes. It's different, you know, when there's just three people versus when there's 10 or however many. Okay, but the same thing with robes, you know, you're allowed to have one set of robes, and then even if you keep an extra set, you don't declare those as yours. You have in your mind that I will give them to somebody else, or I am sharing them with somebody else. Okay, just so you don't get this mind of my, you know, this is my. So lots of times all of our socks get mixed up. I think just forget it, you know. It's very much that mind. We just share our socks, you know, instead of having so many. But so, you know, we should try as monastics not to have a lot of clothes, to have what we need, but not have more than we need. Okay, so, you know, there's only one body, so how many sweaters you need, or how many shirts you need, or how many whatever you need, you know, just to limit it somewhat, so that we don't have drawers stuffed with stuff. And so the extra things, we have a closet downstairs where we put it. And then when people are ordained, or when something, you know, is torn and needs to be replaced, people can go down there and get clothes. And so we should do that rather than wanting new clothes. Okay? So rather than, you know, my whatever is scrub, you know, looking awful, so I'm going to see if somebody will make me a new one, go downstairs and look in the storage room and, you know, see what we have and what fits and use that. As we get bigger, then there's going to be a storekeeper. Yeah, so there's always, usually in the monastery, somebody who's the storekeeper, so that you ask, because otherwise everybody goes and rummages through and doesn't put the things back together again, as we often see. Okay, so we should try and be, you know, considerate of other people when we do that. So similarly, you know, even with general monastery resources, not, you know, holding on to things that we are never really going to use or don't really need, you know, but instead giving them away. But you really see the mind that goes, you know, if I give it away, well, next week for sure I'm going to need it. Yeah. Okay. Whereas some aesthetics and brahmas remain addicted, feeding on the food of the faithful, remain addicted to attending such shows as dancing, singing, music, displays, recitations, hand music, cymbals and drums, fairy shows, acrobatic and conjuring tricks, combats of elephants, buffaloes, bulls, goats, rams, cocks, and quail, fighting with staves, boxing, wrestling, sham fights, parades, maneuvers, and military reviews. The ascetic Gautama refrains from attending such displays. So somebody's going to say, well, they didn't put the Olympics in there. So I'm going to watch the Olympics, And they didn't put the news in there, and they didn't put the soap operas in there, and they didn't put, this and that, my favorite program in there, But, you get the point. It's this kind of entertainment that we watch, with a bag of chips in hand, and... and spend a lot of time just different shows and things and entertainment, right? Okay? Either on the TV, going to the movies, going on the internet. Imagine what would the appearance be if, all the Sangha was going to the movie theaters and watching all these movies with sex and violence? Would you have respect for the Sangha? They spent hours and hours watching these kinds of things. And if it's not good for our own minds either. Yeah, it's a disaster for our own minds. Because you watch this stuff and it imprints, especially, when you're doing meditation practice and your mind gets a little bit quieter, then this stuff can make, such an imprint in your mind. Okay, so parades, military reviews and maneuvers, so all the military parades where, or the Air Force, don't they do something in Seattle every year?
Yeah.
The Blue Angels, and, or just interesting guns and weapons and, what kind of this is that, and, all these kinds of stuff. Okay, whereas some aesthetics and brahmas, feeding on the food of the faithful, remain addicted to such games and idle pursuits as 8 or 10 row chess, chess in the air, hopscotch, spillikin, dicing, hitting sticks, hand pictures, ball games, blowing through toy pipes, playing with toy plows, turning somersaults, playing with toy windmills, measures, carriages, and bows, guessing letters, guessing thoughts, mimicking deformities. The ascetic Gautama refrains from such idle pursuits. Okay? So, playing Crazy Eight, playing solitaire, even on the computer or whatever, ball games and different kinds of things. I remember one person came here and complained that there was no recreation. I was like, I never thought of that. recreation? Recreation. You go in the woods. You take a walk in the woods, or you go pull out some dead willows and maples, and that means for me that's recreation. It's a lot of fun, but I don't know. You're the only person I heard complain about recreation. If you guys complain about recreation, like the Catholic nuns, where you sit with your sewing, you're sewing hoops. You know those things. We did them, yeah. And we sit and sew together and talk together. Please save me from that. Okay. So all those kinds of things. Whereas some ascetics and brahmas feeding on the food of the faithful remain addicted to high and wide beds and long chairs, couches adorned with animal figures, fleecy or variegated coverlets, coverlets with hair on both sides or one side, silk coverlets embroidered with gems or without, elephant, horse, or chariot rugs, choice spreads of antelope hide, couches with awnings or with red cushions at both ends. The ascetic Gautama refrains from such high and wide beds. Okay? So, have you noticed that nobody sleeps on a double bed in the Abbey? We only have single beds. Yeah, you can have an extra long one, don't worry. Well, he said long chairs, you know, so it's okay. Okay, but you know how we take care that we want to have a really nice blanket, or we like nice quilts, and we like it with a nice, quilt cover. You know, that's kind of pretty and of nice material, and a blanket of the right color, and, you know, kind of certain texture that's soft, and, you know, whether you like this kind of sheets or you like the flannel sheets, or, you know, we want our bed exactly one way or another, and we like sitting in chairs where we're the center of attention and they're very laid back and we sink into the chairs and, you know, like this. So, you know, it's really making us aware of where we sit and where we lie down and how we're constantly, you know, just preoccupied with either the comfort of the body or the attractiveness of the things that we're using. So it happens also in the meditation hall. Now, during retreat, it's especially noticeable. Yeah. If you come in and everybody has their own little empire. Yeah. And, you know, so you have your dingwa, okay. But then, you know, you have this and, you know, you have this kind of cushion under this knee and this kind of cushion under that knee. They have to be nice looking cushions, not ugly cushions, and not just, you know, folded up blankets or something like that. And then you have your water bottle and, you know, you have your mala and you have your mala cover, which is a very nice one, and you have your Dharma books with your Dharma book cover. And then all your little statues and pictures of all your teachers lined up in front of you, and then all your Dharma books around, and your favorite blanket in the color that you like, you know, the exact texture and weight that you like, and your favorite shawl because it's cold, and your box of tissues, and your bottle of water, and, you know, your little cough drop, you know, you start coughing in the middle of the session, you want to disturb everybody, and, you know, and we deck out our meditation seat, don't we? Yeah. I think it'd be very interesting this winter to try, and, you know, in the Chinese monasteries, it's very interesting, you'll see when you go. The Chinese, they sleep in a dorm. Everybody's bed looks exactly the same. Everybody has exactly the same pillow, exactly the same quilt that is folded in exactly the same way. All your clothes are put into a cupboard. You only have one cupboard, and it looks exactly like everybody else's cupboard, so you don't get to pick your kind of dresser or your kind of nightstand or your kind of long wicker basket or your kind of whatever that you like to put your stuff in. Everybody's is exactly the same. You walk into the room, you can't tell who sleeps where. Okay? You walk into the study room, it's the same thing. All the books are put away. It's just the table. Yeah? Can't tell one person from the other when they're standing in the meditation hall or standing in the Buddha hall, sitting in the meditation hall. Everybody's seat is exactly the same, you know, and nobody has their whole empire all around them. Okay? So it's very interesting, you know, because this is a way that we create a sense of self, isn't it? Yeah? Actually, you know what we should do? Tonight, when you sit down, everybody rotate one seat to this way, and then that person go back, and then tomorrow morning everybody rotate again. You gotta leave your stuff exactly as it is. You can't change your book. You can't change, you know, your mom, that thing, you know, everything stays exactly where it is. Okay, you can bring your bench, because otherwise she'll cry.
When you're sleeping in Taiwan, are they
going to
check how you sleep?
They come, and when I was there, they came after lunch and made sure we were all lying down.
Yeah,
they wanted us to sleep after lunch. I never sleep in the daytime, so I had to lie down and go to sleep. And then after they walked by, I got up, and then I would do circumambulations of the temple. I don't like to lie down in the middle of the day. Yeah.
Okay.
So, do that. And then the person at the end, you know, however you, if you start here, move there. And then there, then Sarlo, you would come up and sit here. Okay? So the monastics can, the lay people shouldn't sit on the dingwas. Okay, so that one you can move back, but just take it off your cushion. Okay, leave the rest of your everything. Okay, and so just try it and see what it's like. Okay?
It'll be interesting to feel these feel like baby bear, mama bear, papa bear. One's too soft, one's too hot, one's too flat.
Yeah. Actually, you might find something that's more comfortable than you. Yeah. Now, I know you're going to like Kevin's thing because it's purple. He's going to like it. When he gets to Kevin's, he's not going to want to move to the next There's a cushion under his table.
That's the wrong cushion. They're not allowed to use it with the
problem. Okay. Okay, so I think it could be very interesting, you know, just to loosen the sense of, you know, my whatever, okay?
Can we still have our notebooks during teaching?
No. Oh, your notebooks during teachings. Yes, but then you have to put them back on the table during the meditation session. And you can use your own malas, too, but then you have to put them back in there. Okay? Yes, you just try it and see what it's like, okay?
Yeah?
You can't take your mala bags with you, okay?
Just
your malas. Yeah. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. Actually, you know what they do in the Zen monastery? Every 6 months, you change rooms. Yeah, you just pick up everybody, you have like an hour, everybody just change rooms and you rotate rooms. Yeah, so you don't get attached to a room. Okay, whereas some ascetics and brahmas, feeding from the food of the faithful, remain addicted to such forms of self-adornment and embellishment as rubbing the body with perfumes, massaging, bathing in scented water, shampooing, using mirrors, ointments, garlands, scents, unguents, cosmetics, bracelets, headbands, fancy sticks, bottles, swords, sunshades, decorated sandals, turbans, gems, yak-tail fans, Long fringed white robes, the ascetic Gautama refrains from such self-adornment. Okay? So, here, you know, you're talking perfumes, aftershave, everything else. Sometimes the stuff that we use for our aching muscles has a scent, but that can't do much about that. Massaging, okay, when it's talking about massaging, if massage is for health reasons, it's okay, but if it's just to feel good, then you don't do that. Okay, and then all the, you know, cosmetics. You can wear deodorant. Please wear deodorant. Yeah, but not scented stuff. And, you know, chapstick's okay, but and hand lotion, because otherwise things crack and everything. But, you know, I don't think we need other cosmetics so much. Toothpaste is fine. Yeah. Okay, where some ascetics and brahmas remain feeding from the food of the faithful, remain addicted to such unedifying conversation as about kings, robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, wars, food, drink, clothes, beds, garlands, perfumes, relatives, carriages, villages, towns and cities, countries, women, heroes, street and well gossip talk. Street and well gossip. Talk of the departed, desultory chat, speculations about land and sea, talk about being and non-being. The ascetic Gautama refrains from such conversation. Okay? So this is, I think, you know, as citizens of a country, sometimes we have to talk about politics and we should be informed. And, well, some monastics don't vote. I think it's very important that we vote. We're citizens of the country, and I think we should cast our vote in out of compassion for the other people. Okay, but all the talk about you know, with the gossip about the various this or that, that is not being seen from a Dharma light. If you're talking about it from a Dharma light, Dharma perspective, that's one thing. But if you're just sitting and talking about, you know, this, that, or the other, and gossiping about what people are doing, and especially, you know, for example, with relatives here, sometimes, you know, we have to talk about our relatives and explain a situation or our previous conditioning in family, or somebody in the family is sick, and we explain that. But just sitting and gossiping about what the relatives are doing, you know, that's something. Or, you know, I could see talking about real estate and the mortgage scene. If you need to move, go ahead. You know. You know, in some contexts, it might be appropriate to talk about that, but then going on and on and on and on. And so we've noticed that sometimes when we have guests, well, people will talk about very strange things. And so when that happens, we have to learn to, like, bring the conversation back to something about the Dharma. Okay. Where some ascetics and Brahmins, feeding of the food of the faithful, remain addicted to disputation, such as, you don't understand this doctrine and discipline. I do. How could you understand this doctrine and discipline? Your way is all wrong. Mine is right. I am consistent. You aren't. You said last what you should have said first, and you said first what you should have said last. You took so long to think up what has been refuted. Your argument has been overthrown. You're defeated. Go on, save your doctrine. Get out of that if you can. The ascetic Gautama refrains from such disputation. Okay? So, it's kind of debating for the sake of debating, but not really trying to understand the truth or the reality, putting people down, being arrogant, having to have the last word in a conversation, these kinds of things. Whereas some ascetics and Brahmas, feeding of the food of the faithful, remain addicted to such things as running errands and messages, such as for kings, ministers, nobles, Brahmins, householders, and young men who say, go here, go there, take this here, bring that from there. The ascetic Gotama refrains from such errand running. Okay, so keeping yourself busy, running errands, knowing everybody's business. Okay. Whereas some ascetics and Brahmas, seeing of the food of the faithful, remain addicted to deception, patter, hinting, belittling, and are always on the make for further gains, the ascetic Gotama refrains from such deception. Okay, so the kind of mind that's always thinking, how can I get something out of it? How can I talk somebody into giving me this? How can I talk somebody into offering me this? How can I drop hints? How can I flatter? How can I say something so it looks this way? You know, how can I say something to look that way? And so all that kind of deception. So that came up in our discussion quite a bit. You know, people not wanting to be seen as deceptive and two-faced. Okay. So the Buddha agreed with you. Okay. So any comments or questions on that?
About the Buddha's appearance, you mentioned the ears.
Uh-huh.
I'm curious about, is that hair, or for stories of what's on top of his head?
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's very strange how, you know, because the Buddha actually shaves his head.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever we see Buddha statues, he has the crown protrusion, and then he has blue hair, where every single hair is curled to the right individually. Okay, that came about because in ancient India there was these things of great people, and great people had 32 signs and 80 marks. You know, it was kind of in the culture that distinguished them from everybody else. And so the hair, the crown protrusion was one, the hair each individually curling to the right was another, the curl of hair here, the long earlobes, kind of webbed fingers. There's all these kinds of signs. And so I think the statues thereafter got displayed with these signs because it was went along with the signs of the great men, which was part of Indian culture. But in actual fact, Buddha shaped. Anything else? Yeah?
I'm just wondering, there's so many things you have to avoid, right? How do you try and remember everything that is taken?
Okay, so yeah, there's so many things to try and avoid. How do you remember them all? I think rather than get stuck in the specifics, like, you know, the kinds of games to avoid, because, you know, you may not play those games anyway. You know, they didn't list Scrabble and Monopoly and video games and Nintendo and, you know, what was that one you were talking about? Your friends were asking you to get special points on, you know, those things. Okay? So that isn't, just because that isn't listed in there, you know, it doesn't mean that it's okay to do them. So these kinds of things, you remember the category, you know, the main principle. Yeah. So if I was going to review the section that we covered today, the main principles, we're destroying seeds, which I have some question about. Okay. Hoarding possessions that you don't need. And like I said, you know, we've adapted that nowadays because of the circumstance of the monasteries and so on. Attending entertainment, you know, just for the heck of it. Games and idle pursuits, you know, high and expensive seats and beds, adornment and jewelry and perfumes and scents and things that make us more attractive, unedifying conversation, okay, disputation that has no purpose, running errands and messages, in other words, being a gossip and knowing everybody's business, and then deception and hinting, flattering, these kinds of things. Okay, so if we remember the main categories, then, so you can see something like the ones about deception, those would be probably naturally negative because they're lesser forms of lying. Okay? But ones about, let's say, entertainment, they wouldn't be naturally negative actions. It would depend upon your motivation very much when you were doing them. Okay? But still, it creates a, you know, a not good visualization. It doesn't mean that you can't have fun. Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to have fun. Other things? Yeah.
For the one with deception.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty clear when we don't lie.
Mm-hmm.
But then sometimes for the good, for people's benefit, we have to not be completely forthright.
Yeah.
I would say, and not lie particularly, but I would consider deception.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's kind of a thought in my mind that like, oh, I'm intentionally going to leave this information out because it'll benefit the person.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you
know, things, I think you have to look at what the situation is. Exactly. You know, people say to me sometimes that, you know, their relatives may get upset if they're going to the Dharma Center. So I don't think that your relatives need to know everywhere you're going all the time. But if you just say, I'm going out with friends, it's sufficient, rather than them getting hysterical every time you go to the Dharma Center. You know, I think it's, you know, that's just my take on it. You know, I don't see it as deception. I see it as having a little bit of privacy in your life when you're an adult. Yeah. So, you know, there's certain things where, you know, if it's going to, I mean, you look at it situation by situation. Yeah. And if it's really going to drastically alter the outcome, you know, you're asked to testify at court, and by not giving some information, it's going to kind of totally bring around the wrong thing. Well, clearly that's being deception. But then there's other things where, you know, if somebody asks me, the example I always use, how I like the food and I don't like it, I say, thank you very much for cooking. It's really kind of you to make this meal. And I don't feel like I'm being deceptive. You know, in other words, I don't think that being truthful means you have to fully disclose everything about a situation. Otherwise, we would be talking forever, wouldn't we? You know, if I asked you just one simple question, if you had to fully disclose everything, you know, we'd never get anything done at the Abbey. Yeah? So you have to pick out the important points and tell what the important points are. But clearly something important is being left out that makes a major difference. Yeah? Okay? But maybe it's better to talk about specific situations. I don't know. Or maybe everybody just looks at it themselves, you know, what their own thing is. Yeah? Because I know you've brought that up so many times, sins of omission.
Mm-hmm.
But like I say, you know, I mean, somebody asked me a question. I don't feel like I have to reveal everything about my whole life to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, sometimes it's just not appropriate. They don't need to know that, and it takes too long, and they don't want to hear it anyway. And, yeah? So I think you see it situation by situation. You know, I mean, clearly if you're a monastic and you went to the bar when you were in town and you come back to the monastery and somebody says, where did you go in town? And you say, I went to Albany Falls and I went to the post office, and you left out saying I went to the bar, that would be deception. Okay? Yeah, because that's clearly something that, you know, we shouldn't be doing. Okay? Anything else?